This evening with Oddball Pilot, we're going to discuss glass cockpits, and the G1000 kind of sparked the conversation, a comment I made about how I'm not real fond of them, and James was asking what I didn't like, and there are lots of pluses and minuses to the G1000 and to glass cockpits. And joining us is Alex Haynes, who's flown them, Mike Singer, of course, who's more techie than I am and understand why it may or may not be better, and hopefully Travis will call in. And Bailey's with us right now as well. So we, of course, can deviate from the topic if we wish to talk about something else. Or Bailey, if you have any questions relating starting flying or anything you want to ask about, feel free to ask at any time. So and where were we? We were actually talking about avalanches and mudslides when we deviated. But I'm kind of curious, Bailey, but you're just sort of starting off flying, that's correct? Oh,
sorry,
Bailey. Yeah, I just had a question for you. Since you're just starting off a flying career, I'm curious when you've looked around at schools if the training planes have more G1000s in them or if you're seeing more of the old steam gauges in the training planes.
It's about half and half now. At North Air, they offer both. The steam gauge is actually cheaper to train in. I'm also very active. I'm the IT officer here at the Civil Air Patrol Squadron, and we've got a new 2007 Cessna 182 Turbo with a full G1000 package in it. And
okay. Cool.
They use it extensively because it really helps with our grid searches when we're doing search and rescue or other type of missions. And they provided me with some G1000 training software from Garmin. If you have a dual-screen computer set up, you can set that up and just sit there all day and play with the G1000 console.
Well, that's what I want to sort of preface this. I talked to, again, Travis, who's works for Affic Air, so he sells Cessnas, and he knows kind of probably a better idea of what Garmin was trying to do with the G1000.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean this as an attack on a G1000. And I think there's some really good aspects to it. Like, I love the navigation page, which is probably what you use for those searches.
Yes.
There are just a few key points that I think Garmin could probably change pretty easily, and I just don't know if anybody's considered it, that I think don't help it out. I also read some recent articles about how it's easier to transition from steam gauges to G1000 or glass cockpits rather than the other way around. So I'm thinking it might be easier to learn a G1000 initially, like the way it's set up may be more intuitive for a newer starting pilot, especially someone who's used computers a fair amount. But yeah, maybe steam gauges take longer to learn when you're starting out. And I don't know if that's accurate either, but that was one thought I kind of had.
That's interesting. I always thought with the fact that it's hard to transition to steam gauges after the G1000, I always thought that was because, that's a good question. Now that I think about it, I guess I kind of assumed it was because you have so much information that it's almost like knowing how to drive a car and then suddenly you have to ride a bike. That's a poor analogy, but it's like there's not enough there, and I think people have trouble with that. But what you said just makes sense, actually, that or I guess the question has to be asked, like, is it actually it might be harder to transition to steam gauges, but is it easier to start with glass, and if so, why? And it's a hard question to answer because, by definition, you can't start both ways. You know, I guess you could have control groups and kind of do a study and see what people say, but I think whether it is and why is a really interesting question.
Well, my feeling on that is that with the entire screen on G1000 is a horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And as Mike, we were just talking about this before this call, and I that's more intuitive when you're starting out because it replicates what you're seeing outside the cockpit. And so initially that is easier. What I found just having delivered a plane with a G1000 and then flew two planes with steam gauges, I've flown steam so much I'm very good at or I think I'm good at, eliminating the instruments I don't need, and I just concentrate on the ones I need. Now, with the G1000, with that horizon cutting through different gauges, it cuts through your airspeed and your altimeter, it's harder for me to isolate what I'm trying to look at. I'm forced to try to take in more information than I want to see.
I have to agree on that. The ball on the glass cockpit drives me insane.
I'm totally with you. I'd totally forgotten about that, and that drives me batty. I want a ball.
Yeah.
And you gotta know what your bank angle is going to be for a standard rate turn.
Yeah. It drives me nuts. I hate it with a passion.
Well, and part of my most stuff I see on the glass is always positive. And so I'm not sure the companies get real accurate feedback, because I'm sure they could change a lot of the things that we're going to talk about that we don't like. They could change it and make it more user-friendly. Or, since it is a computer screen, you could choose how you want to set it up. And that would strike me as actually the better option. Like, you could maybe have instead of having the whatever it's called up there, the little triangle that you keep in the center for the ball, you'd actually could make it make a ball at the bottom.
Yeah, something Aiden and I have talked about a lot, and Alex, you probably know this already, but for the value of anybody else who will listen to this recording, you know, everyone talks about our glass panels better, our flat panels better, and the reality is they're just computer screens, and you can present anything on a computer screen. In fact, all the flight simulation stuff that I've worked on over the years has gotten to a point where on a computer screen, you can make stuff look exactly like, you know, a 3D steam gauge panel that if you took a picture of the screen, you would think was real. So, you know, I always said way back when this stuff first came out, you know, part of the advantage is it's a computer screen. You don't have all these mechanical parts, and then you don't need a vacuum system. You can have AHARs and stuff, and that's all, you know, that's hard to argue with. But the actual interface and the design of new gauges and all of that, that's really where all these debates are, because you could very easily just have a glass panel that looks exactly like your steam gauge panel, like exactly the same. And in fact, Southwest Airlines, until they upgraded all their next-gen 737s, it was when they got rid of their old 737s that they finally went to the new format, I think. But when they started introducing the next-gen, they actually had the primary flight display set up with what were kind of like steam gauges, and it was because their pilots would go, you know, back and forth between the planes, and they wanted a common type rating, I guess, and stuff like that. So you can do anything you want with computer screens, which, to Aiden's point, is part of the question. It's like, you know, if some specific features of this are counterintuitive or people have different preferences, it's not that hard to give people options or make it different. And some of the design decisions really make you scratch your head, and you're like, why did they do that? And I know Aiden has a list of things that bother him, and they're probably things that if somebody learning to fly on a G1000 has never flown another airplane with steam gauges, they would never even think about. But because people like you, Alex, and Aiden are always going back and forth, I think you're more aware of these differences.
I think Alex may like the G1000 more than I do.
I remember the first time I got in one, it was down in Florida in a 206. I was taken to Africa. I think maybe that was, and Aiden was in the 182. And we took off to test fly these planes with the ferry systems, and instantly I was lost because I wasn't familiar with where I was flying, and I didn't know how to work this thing. And there was so much information, it took me a few minutes to figure out where I was and how to figure out how to get back to where I needed to be. And it was pretty funny. Do you remember that experience, Aiden?
Yeah, it was my first time. As both of us, I remember talking on the radio, neither one of us had flown glass or a G1000, and we both jumped to these things and just took off without paying any attention to it. I mean, good thing it was Florida and good weather. But I also recall we had them pretty well dialed by the time we'd flown all the way up the Eastern Seaboard to Bangor. So the system's definitely not difficult to learn, and I'm not sure that would have been as easy going the opposite direction, going to steam gauges. You know, somebody had learned on glass, they might have had a, if they jumped in a steam gauge plane, that might have been a more difficult transition. And from what I've read, that seems to be true.
To address something Mike just said about having the options of changing the format and the display the way you want with the steam gauges, you really couldn't do that. They were pretty much all the same. There were little fuel variations, but the format and the positioning of everything was very, very standard across types of planes.
Well, and that's actually a good point I hadn't thought of, because having you know, flown for companies where they'll always try to standardize their airplanes, but it rarely happens. So you jump in one plane, and usually your standard six-packs are normal, but not always. It's not always the same either. So without the G1000 does bring a standard system to every plane that has it. You jump in a plane with a G1000, you know what you have. Whereas before, you jump in a plane with steam gauges, and you sometimes have to search around to figure out where they'd put, you know, a VOR, you know, it wasn't always the same. And that's,
and
that's
yet,
a good point.
You know, the technology evolves and the G1000 keeps coming out with new versions. And, you know, there's generally not big changes, but, you know, things like the altitude bug, you know, originally that couldn't be tied to an autopilot. Like there was an altitude bug, but that was just for reference. And there's lots of other things that if you look at the revisions of the software, like any software, you know, they change things. So, you know, now you have, you know, the synthetic vision, and that's not available on the early versions, which a lot of planes still have. So it actually really complicates things for people like me involved on the training side, because if you're writing books or making courseware or even teaching classes, it's hard to keep up with it all because it can change so quickly because it is just software. And I think for pilots too, you know, it's like Microsoft Word or anything else. There's always something new to learn with every version. The good news is you can usually turn that new stuff off if you don't like it or you just find it overwhelming.
And they have done well with that. It's when I pick planes up that John Price worked for Africa Air, and he'll fly them from Wichita to down to Florida often. So when I pick him up and after he's flown him, he's got every whiz-bang feature of G1000 pulled up. You've got synthetic vision. You've got the little green where you're going to be in 15-second thing floating around. And if I forget to turn it off before I take off, I just don't even look at it. I mean, honestly, there's too much stuff there. I don't need all that information, and it makes it really confusing.
Well, sounds like you're saying one of the hazards then is that if you get in the habit of tuning something out visually, then you're ignoring information that's in front of you because there's too much information. So
that's
you got to train yourself not to ignore that, I guess.
That's you're getting too much information that isn't necessary to fly. That's one of my gripes. Now, you can declutter, you can get rid of all that information. So it's not really a valid gripe because you can get rid of it. And I suspect for different people that'll be a different level of what they want to get rid of. I pretty much dumb it down to nothing except there's a little wind thing. It shows you where the wind's coming from. That's just fun to look at. The synthetic vision and the little thing telling you where you're going to be in 15 seconds or whatever it is, we're not going fast enough in a caravan for that to be an issue. And synthetic vision, I have serious questions about the validity of synthetic vision. I just don't see why if you're flying instruments, you fly your instruments. You don't want to see where the hills are. You should be, you know, following published procedures. And if you're not, you've got a problem. If you're flying in the mountains with the synthetic vision, that's probably not very wise.
Yeah, I think a lot of what you're saying to me, and I think it comes from kind of the side of aviation that I'm in, it comes down to training. And I think there's a lot of instructors who probably teach people that you need all this stuff. And I know of a couple instructors who do the opposite, who the first thing they do, especially if someone's transitioning from steam gauges, is they dumb it down and they just say, okay, here are the essential things. And those things you know from steam gauges, hear how they're represented differently on the G1000. And all this other stuff, like, you don't need. You know, for example, even in a steam gauge plane, when GPSs came along, you know, there's a tendency to get fixated on the GPS. The reality is you don't need the GPS in order to fly, right? Aviate, navigate, communicate, or aviate, yeah, navigate, communicate. You can aviate without any of that stuff. So with the G1000, even a lot of the navigation features, you don't need just to fly the plane. And I think the disservice that's done by a lot of instructors and training material is students, especially new pilots, they see it all and it's all glowing and there's all these features and they think they need to learn all of it. And then they learn all of it. And then if any of it is taken away because of a failure or they get into a plane that has an earlier version of the software or, God forbid, a steam gauge plane, they think they can't fly the airplane because they think all that's important. And I think good instruction says, you know, and it's the same way with software of any kind, with Windows, with Office, with anything. If you're teaching somebody, and, you know, I do this with my parents, you explain to them what the essentials are, and then you explain what all the optional stuff is and why you would want to use it and when you would want to use it. And I think
that
knowledge is key.
You do that with your parents.
Well, I do it with you.
You do it with me when you're talking about computers.
But I think I think that's part of it. And there's when I was in college, I studied philosophy of technology for a while. And there's a huge tendency to focus on the technology and blame technology for things when a lot of it, in this case, when you're talking about software, has to do with how that technology is being used, how the people using it are being trained, all of that. So I'm kind of interested, like, Alex, do you prefer, like, given a choice, all other things being equal, do you prefer the G1000 to steam gauges, or are there certain situations in which you still prefer steam gauges? And if so, why do you prefer one or the other?
I prefer, well, now I prefer the glass because I'm really used to it. I can still get back into any cockpit, I guess. But there's more information there, and it's all displayed right in front of you. You can pull up all kinds of stuff, so I definitely prefer the glass.
And there are times when I think it is better. Generally on the ferry flights, where I'm doing so much straight and level, it works just fine, and I'm also autopilot on, you know, a huge part of the time. I don't like that I can't dim them enough, but that's just, you know, yeah, I can deal with that. And the nav screen is really good, and it gives me all the current approach plates and charts, which are awesome. If you're getting into a VFR flying condition, and, like, I wondered about this when I was flying those planes in Nepal, I think even Alaska, where your approach speed is going to be more critical, and you're really flying visually, you're looking outside the airplane more, and you're just using the instruments as very quick reference points, I find the strips that you're trying to read not easy to read. Like, if I'm trying to hold 70 knots, I can look down and see a needle is about 70 knots. I don't need to hold, you know, I just need to know it's right in there. And often it's bouncing around because there's turbulence or, you know, you're holding 71, you know, 69 to 71 knots. With the vertical strip, it's hard to see that you're roughly in the place you want to be. You actually have to read a number. So for straight-up cruising airline-type flying, I do think the glass works fine, autopilot on. If you're doing more VFR flying, I think it's getting use a lot of unnecessary information, and the way it's presented is not as readable, not as useful. And that's really my problem with this. I think this is technology that started with the military and then the airlines, and now it's getting into smaller and smaller planes. You're seeing them in Super Cubs. And I'm not sure that it's appropriate presentation.
Well, there's something they can do for instance, on the airspeed strip that you get, I've been flying some citations, and you program your environmental conditions on landing, and it brings up your mm-hmm. approach and over-the-fence airspeeds. And so you've got a little narrow range in there that you hold it on final approach, and that's something that you can see without really looking at it to actually read the number. And that's mm-hmm. one thing that they don't have on G1000 that I think they should.
Well, you can set in your own V speeds, and I think it includes the ability to set an approach speed bug.
You can put a bug in, but it's really small. It's just like
the
glide slope is really small and really hard. It's not real obvious. They rely on using color for a lot of things as well to alert you to something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't particularly like that. I don't pick up colors quite as well. A needle is just so easy to see, and I don't even read, if I want a 70 knots, I don't read 70 knots. I see the needle is about where I need it on that airspeed indicator, and then you're
mm-hmm.
back outside the plane. It doesn't detract from your feel for the aircraft, which a lot of the really short field stuff, you need to be, there's you're feeling the plane as much as reading a gauge, and the
mm-hmm.
gauges are a great tool, but they're not your primary source of information. It's more seat of the pants. And I find G1000 stuff or the glass cockpit stuff to be really poor for that. And
so
I'm going to go on for a second. Let me throw this in here real quick, Mike.
Go ahead.
The citation, I flew a ProLine 21 system in a King Air, and I really liked it. So I think these more expensive glass cockpits that they put in, faster airplanes, more technologically advanced airplanes, I think that's a more appropriate place for a glass cockpit system, too. And some of these better, these more expensive systems may be better thought out.
Well, and arguably the G1000, not arguably because it's true, but in many cases, the G1000 presents more information than even a lot of sort of first high-tech generation airliners have. So, when you look at the first glass panel airliners and even some, regional airliners now, or even big jets, they don't necessarily provide all the information that a G1000 provides. And, your argument that, it's overkill for, VFR and a 172, that is an interesting question.
Go ahead.
Well, I have a question for Alex and Aiden, which is, when you're back in the day when you're learning to fly on steam gauges, you do a lot of stuff in your head, right? Prior to GPSs or any navigational technology like that, you really had to create the situational awareness in your mind and create that mental map, and you were constantly, in some cases looking at one instrument like, a VOR indicator or an HSI. But in a lot of cases, you're looking at that and your heading indicator and a DME, and then you're taking all that stuff, combining that in your head, looking at the chart that's on your lap, a piece of paper, and then putting all that together in your head so that you have this mental model of situational awareness in terms of where you are and where you're headed and where things are. There's probably an argument to be made that doing that is valuable because at any given moment, you do know where you are in your head because you have to do that. When you have all these moving maps, nobody would say it's bad for situational awareness, but it sort of takes your brain out of it. And so I have two questions for you guys. One, obviously if the technology fails, and you don't have that mental situational awareness and you haven't been really paying attention too much, you're kind of screwed. But even without a failure of the technology, do you think there's something lost by just handing that to people? And the simplest example is, prior to GPSs with maps on them, you didn't have at a glance knowledge of where you were. Like, you had all this information, and you could figure that out looking at a chart and using your finger. But you can glance at something and immediately know where you are. Do you think that even without failures of technology, something is lost by having all this in front of you, or is it actually better because you can use your brain for something else?
Well, I think I'd rather shouldn't hog it here, but I think there are a couple things on that. As long as the technology is going this way, and most people do go to the airlines where they have this type of technology, it doesn't really matter that you're going to have this technology. And it doesn't really fail that frequently. I mean, it's almost unheard of. Do you need to have that situational awareness? My pop and I were just talking about this morning, actually, which is interesting. I don't think you necessarily need it anymore. Now, if you're going to go backwards and go to steam gauge or do more VFR flying, you're back to where you do need that situational awareness, and you may not have developed it. The primary things I've always wanted from a GPS are bearing to the station I've plugged in there, my track, my ground speed, and the distance. And that's because I started out with simple GPSs. That's all they had. And that's all I really like to see now. And the moving map, when they first came out with moving maps, I never used the moving maps. I found it a distraction. Now I can use the moving maps partly because you can't avoid them. But I did notice other pilots I flew with, this was at Everett, their cargo, they actually liked you to have the map in there. But it was really kind of a worthless map. But clearly other pilots did like having that map. And I just never liked having it. The captain I first flew with at Everett Air Fuel, when I started there, they'd just put a GPS in the DC-6. He'd never flown or hadn't flown a lot with GPSs. And he would always revert back to what he called the Columbus method. And if we were scud running in bad weather, he would have me, he's usually flying, I'd pull the chart out, and we'd just use the GPS to pull up our lat and long. And then I would just plot the lat and long on the chart. I'd come up with, okay, Ron, you better turn left now.
I like having that moving map, and maybe that's why I like the G1000 as much as for any reason, is because it really helps with my situational awareness in places where, like from Egypt to Russia, the controllers will send you right through a localizer without telling you. So let's say you're on approach and you're on radar heading to intercept, and you, without that moving map displayed, you may not be aware of how close you are to the localizer when you're still at very, like a 90-degree angle, and their plan is to send you right through, and they don't tell you. And then it's a real surprise. And with that moving map display, this is just one example of how I can anticipate, and so it's not a surprise. I can ask them, is this your intention to send me through the localizer?
It's also extremely good for avoiding airspace. It'll pop up and show you the air. And as airspace around the world has gotten more complicated, I think the moving map has more of a purpose along those wells, keeping you within compliant with the rules. I will say, when I first picked up the steam gauge caravan after taking that G1001 to Nairobi, there was about a 5-minute period of like, darn, I really wish I had moving map. But after 5 minutes, I actually was by the 2 or 3 hours into that trip, I was happy to be back to the steam gauges.
I think what we're trying to say is that, to address Mike's point, I think definitely if you develop the situational awareness on steam gauges, you'll be fine in glass, of course. But then if you've developed your situational awareness in glass with moving that display, and you have to go back to steam gauges, then you're going to start, it's going to be a real struggle.
Right. Go ahead, Ed.
Oh, I can think of actually a situation where it actually would work against you starting in steam gauges, but this is only because I've met pilots like this, and hopefully I'm not one. If you learned on Steam and when you get in something with Glass, you just refuse to use some of the features that are useful because you just are being stubborn and don't think you need it. And that can happen. Go ahead, Mike.
You know, one of the sort of most dreaded type of Steam gauge activities that you can do is a NDB approach with wind, and not homing so much, but tracking. And that's like this real sort of old school skill, which once you get it down is really not that difficult. But then when you can do, you know, the same approach using a GPS with the map, like it's a complete no-brainer. And, you know, that shows in some ways how this technology, you know, enables you to move the airplane in the same place, on the same path through the sky in a way that's much less mentally taxing. But I do wonder, you know, and this ties into the whole question of automation in general, I think it puts more onus on the pilot to stay active and stay in the loop. Like what you were talking about, Alex, like, you know, it's great that the map shows you the localizer, and if you're paying attention, you can see if you're flying through it and being vectored through it, but you need to be paying attention. And I think when you're forced to engage with that situational awareness using steam gauges on something like an NDB approach, you're already there because you have to be, because if you stop paying attention, you're going to totally lose your awareness. So I think the Glass, you know, it really demands more attentional control on the part of the pilot, because especially if you're using autopilot, it's so easy to just tune out and just let the autopilot fly the airplane according to the flight plan that's in the GPS, and you don't really have to pay attention. And as you pointed out, and when you get into weather and stuff like that, there's even more in traffic stuff that you can pay attention to that's useful. You know, if you pay attention, there is a lot there that's helpful, but you really do need to pay attention. And I would argue that the technology almost makes it seem like you don't need to pay attention.
I thought that exact same thing on these last flights, honestly, because I just took that one plane to Nairobi, the G1000, and when I jumped in the plane with the steam gauge, I am much more engaged with the airplane and what the airplane and I are doing. With the Glass, you know, once you plug everything into the nav page, I'm much more inclined to sit back, read a book, and just the plane will do it just fine. And it's funny, Gally and I were just talking about this with the float plane about how good a pre-flight you want to do on the float plane, you know, if they're on the dock.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you obviously do it as much as you need for a pre-flight, but it's like, but you could always do this and this and this and this. And we were just laughing. We're like, it all just depends on how much you want to bond with your airplane. And with
right.
the G1000, with the Glass system, I tend to bond much less because I turn over more control to the automated systems. Certainly in the U.S. and Europe, where you can dial in VORs with G1000, when I'm flying the Garmin-equipped plane, I tend to not bother dialing in VORs when I'm going by them. And with steam gauges, partly because it's just really easy. You just go and reach over the radio, and you just dial in the next VOR switch frequency, and there you are. So it's an easy interface, and I'm much more inclined to dial in VORs, you know, as I go past them and keep track of where I am on my chart. With Garmin, I'm not very inclined to do that. And I have thought in the past if something went wrong and I lost that nav page with the Garmin, I would be struggling. I'd be pulling the maps out and, you know, the charts out to figure out where I am, and I'd figure it out. But with the steam gauges, I'm always there. I'm up to speed as I go along. And that's just me, and it's a complacency thing. So that's my own fault.
So Alex, what would you tell somebody, because I just got asked this question actually by my accountant who I was thinking about learning to fly, and the flight school he went to look at Payne Field was, you know, really pushing the G1000 aircraft, and he asked me, you know, which would you recommend to start in, and what I told him, and I just want to get other people's opinion, was It's easier to go from steam to glass. And if you learn on steam, you're, because of that fact, you're sort of opening yourself up to an easier time flying all different kinds of airplanes. And going the other direction really only makes sense if you really intend on flying glass and never going back. But Alex, I'm curious.
Right.
What would you tell someone?
You train for what you're going to fly. So if you, mm-hmm. if you're pretty certain that you're just going to fly glass, and never look back, then, do your initial, in glass. But I think the consensus out there, and I agree with this, is that you want to learn on a basic six pack of instruments. You want to learn basic instrument skills and get your instrument rating on basic instruments and be able to fly those.
And I think Bailey actually answered part of that question too. They're cheaper. They're charging less for the steam gauge equipped planes.
They are.
Money.
So that's going to keep them in the cockpit a little bit longer too.
Oh, yeah, it might.
No.
If I might add, I noticed that, you know, while flying with CAP, you've got a lot of older fashioned people that have done nothing but steam gauges. And they've gotten used to the primary flight display, but it's the multifunction display with a moving map that really kills them. And I noticed that, you know, in some cases they should really be spending a lot more time on the ground learning that multifunction display because it's not user-friendly enough for them.
Right.
And they will sit up there in that aircraft playing with that damn thing while I'm in the back, you know, looking for traffic because they got their heads right into that MFD and they are just so confounded with it. And I think, I think you got to hit this button. Well, no, you turned the wrong knob and just, wow, it's overly complicated.
So how long is it? Do you have a rough idea how long it's taking them to adjust to where they're properly paying attention outside and managing the thing?
Some of them are doing pretty well. Others are just like not so well. it just confounds them.
Can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Flying it.
I'm sorry.
I'm thinking some of it just depends on how much they're actually flying it. Holy cow. Is a CAP, you don't always fly that much. So if they're
right.
in the plane, you know, once every couple months, they're just never getting the chance to figure it out.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the big thing because we were all given the training software, and some of these people that don't fly as much as the other CAP people, they're not training enough. And you know, that's really on them. But there is in defense, though, there is a lot to that moving display. I've made the personal decision that I want to do my private and my instrument on steam gauges, and then I'll move up to the G1000 or whatnot when I go for my commercial.
Well, the other reason to do that is a lot of people do think they're going to go right on from, you know, their initial training, flight instructor, the same school and the same equipment, and then end up at a commuter airline and fly glass all the way through. I'm not sure that's the actual reality. You know, a lot of people are going to end up in Alaska or flying skydivers.
Right.
Which
is probably, I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I know enough to where I don't want to be an airline pilot myself.
Yeah, and I think it behooves anyone to be proficient on both systems in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't. Go ahead.
Oh, I just noticed a lot of aircraft over in Afghanistan, like the contractors, I think they called AAR, that they run the Dash 8s out there. They were all steam.
Yep, AAR runs them. You've got Dyne Corps over there. The planes I delivered were for a contractor, those steam gauge planes, and, yeah, they're not running the newest equipment necessarily.
Yeah, and that's important to realize, too, that we're not just talking small airplanes because everybody thinks, you know, steam gauges, that's, you know, Cessnas, Pipers, small aircraft. But there are still a lot of, you know, jets and turboprops that are all steam gauges. And, you know, I would guess, I don't know, Aiden, what do you think? I'd guess that most of the jobs that we've interviewed people about for the website are right now flying steam gauge aircraft, regardless of the mission or how big they are.
I've got a question.
Go ahead.
What do you guys think about operating a hybrid system, your basic six-pack steam gauge gauges, but having just MFD on the right side, just your moving map? Think of
I would love it.
A fusion of that.
Yeah, that's kind of my point, is this technology is here to stay. It's a lot cheaper to build, a lot cheaper to put in airplanes. It sounds like it's cheaper to maintain. So it's not going anywhere. But it's like, and what I would like to have is a really realistic discussion on what parts of this are good, and how can we incorporate some of the old technology and the new technology, and actually build a cockpit that is efficient, utilize the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody's really doing that. And I think a lot of it is actually cost driven. I think these systems are so much, they're so much cheaper to build and put in the planes, that everybody's just going with them, and it's inevitable. A hybrid system, even, and we lost track of, there was one good question there we were having a minute ago. Let me backtrack for a second in terms of operators that are using steam that might be flying bigger planes. If you go to a small cargo airline that flies worldwide, like Kitty Hawk or Atlas, they're flying big jets, but you're likely to get old steam gauges. Everett Air Cargo is now flying DC-9s, and their first year at least of operating them, they didn't even have GPS in there, no GPS, and they're flying VOR to VOR, and they are old-style steam gauges in there, and I don't think that's going to change for them for a while. So you are, there's a good chance you're going to end up flying steam at some point, even if you think you're not. So it's worth learning. I just want to get that in.
Alex, have you flown any planes that have, you know, pretty complex and advanced multifunction displays or like super high-end GPSs?
Aiden was saying about the ProLine 21, that's pretty much, that's a high end, and that's about as high end as I've gone. And those don't have synthetic vision.
Right.
And you can put your shorelines, your maps, but the maps on those things aren't as detailed as the surface map on the G1000. So I really pay attention to where cities and airports and rivers and shorelines and mountains and everything is. So I really like having all that information on my moving map display. Mm-hmm. What Bailey was asking about, the kind of the hybrid system, I took one airplane that had a Chelton synthetic vision. It was about 10 years ago, and it was before the G1000 was in the Caravan. And Chelton was competing with Garmin to try and get this in. And it wasn't certified for IFR, but this guy put it in the plane. So he also had to have all the regular analog instruments in there as well. And so the panel was a one-of-a-kind. It was packed. It had, you know, three glass screens and everything else.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was... it was a lot of work to fly that plane.
That's interesting. I saw a picture once online. It was from a Canadian aircraft. I think it's called the Expedition. It's that four-door high wing. It's got a really wide cabin. When you guys are familiar with those.
That one. No, sounds interesting, though.
Yeah, the plexiglass, you know, your windows goes down to your feet. It's crazy. You can take the doors off. But anyways... the Expedition, they had literally put in, this is where I got the idea from, was they actually put your standard six-pack in the left side, the pilot side, with a few of the other gauges, you know, your VOR and whatnot. But the right side, the co-pilot one, just had the MFD, the moving map, from Garmin. It was pretty, I think it was a custom setup, but it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I looked at that and I thought, okay, I know exactly what they're doing. And it was the point that you brought up, Aiden, was the fact that you want that whatever information you're looking for right now, like say your airspeed, you've got that steam gauge instant access right there, and then you want to move over to the MFD whenever you're doing the more navigational thing.
Well, then I think
Island Air Express, when I went up and talked to them up there and flew in their Garrett Equit caravan, they had the Chelton system, which was part of the stuff they had, the Capstone 2. And I liked what they had going on. They had a good system. It wasn't a full screen for the main flight display, but it was pretty effective, and I did like the way they had that set up. So I think sort of a hybrid bridge can work, and some of the technology really is good if it's done right.
And I think you're going to see more of the hybrid stuff in the future as GPSs become really multifunction displays, and I'm working on courseware for one right now. You have the Garmin 43530, which has been replaced with the GTN series touchscreen, which provides even more information. And that's just a separate unit, right, that you just have as your NavCom GPS. But then you also have all these retrofits now with all these products where you can put in one or more panels that are flat, and they're designed to replace instruments on the panel, like I forget what it is. It used to be the GTX. I forget what the new one is from Garmin, but it basically replaces two of the instruments, so the attitude indicator and the HSI, but you can leave the other instruments. And then you can have an identical panel over to the right that's acting as an MFD. And then you can move from that stuff into a whole discussion about iPads, which, with ForeFlight and other software, can basically provide a lot of this MFD-type stuff. I think, right now the debate is still a little bit about, glass cockpit or not, G1000 or not. I think as it becomes easier and less expensive to retrofit existing airplanes, you'll see more of this sort of Franken-cockpit. And with jets, the first example of that I know of was sort of the 767-57 cockpit, where you had an attitude indicator and I think the HSI were glass, but then you still had, and they actually had tape on them that you could turn off if you wanted to for the airspeed and altitude, but you also had the physical instruments. And that's an example of an airplane that to this day sort of has a hybrid approach. And, a lot of jets have a flight management system, but it's really more like a Garmin GPS. It's separate from all the technology you use for the other systems of the plane. And the G1000, the reason we keep talking about it is that's all integrated. The engine monitoring stuff is there. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. But it's still the same dilemma. It's just, is it on one screen or is it on five different screens and your iPad?
Interesting. I pulled up the Expedition aircraft. You just mentioned it, and I think it's the Found company, which is you see them up in Alaska. And interestingly, I was looking at the sales pitch for them, and they've got the Garmin G500 with synthetic vision technology for the ultimate mountain flying machine.
Yes,
and,
but that was not what I seen somebody that was not from the company. It was a personal owner had done a custom work on his Expedition.
Well, and one of my points is that they're selling the G1 or the G500 synthetic vision as the ultimate mountain flying tool.
Right.
I just don't see it. I don't know why. If you're flying VFR in the mountains, you shouldn't have. It's distracting to see these little mountains pop up on your attitude indicator, basically. And if you're going to go instruments, you should transition to the instruments and get out of there. I guess it could provide some idea of where to not fly if you, you know, unexpectedly, inadvertently went into IFR. But it's when I've flown with synthetic vision in the mountains out there, it breaks up my horizon and makes it actually harder for me to keep track of what the plane's actually doing. It's a cool plane, though. It's awesome looking. And it's not a super cub from people have talked about these founds. They say they are really cool, but they're not super cubs.
Alex, I have a question because Aiden and I talk about this all the time, and I'm just curious what your experience is. You probably talked to Aiden about this. You know how on a G1000 PFD, the glide slope indicator is co-located with the airspeed, I mean the altitude tape. It's not down on the HSI.
That's always been Aiden's number one complaint about that.
Exactly. So I'm curious for your perspective on that.
Well, I don't know the history of the development because the PFDs in all the jets, they're all like that. The glide slopes over there on the altitude tape. And I don't know if it's to just help with this. The idea was to change the way you scan because I really would like to have the cross. You've got your CDI and your glide slope, and they come together in the middle, and that's your primary focus on your scan. And so you've got to break up your scan when you're trained to have those things together. Now you've got to look from one to the other, and so I don't know whose idea that was and why it developed that way, but that's kind of just the way it is. I think that probably came out of the military jets at first, and it was somebody's bright idea. So, I mean, I've gotten used to it. I can handle it, but it would have been nice to have that cross down there on the HSI.
Yeah, it's funny because on the horizontal side, You have the needle on the HSI, but then you also have, there's a little indicator up on the attitude indicator. It's like at the bottom of it, I think. There's like a little bar that shows your OBS sort of offset, and that's providing dual functionality, right? And I think their thinking is you're primarily focused on the attitude, and at a glance, all in one line, you can get all the information you need. But it is interesting to think about, why don't they also put a needle down below just so you could use it if that's what you're used to? I would bet that people who learn on glass would never even question what we're talking about. But if you have hundreds or thousands of hours of flying on instruments, looking at an HSI with that cross, it is really disconcerting and confusing not to have it there.
You got to be trained.
Yeah, there are two things for that. And also the glide slope they put on there up on the altitude is really small. It's not very obvious. It's a little blue diamond. Your primary instrument when you're on an ILS is not your attitude indicator. That's not what you're staring at. You're staring at your crosses. And I think Garmin was thinking, you're always using this huge attitude indicator. And again, flying these steam gauges, I shot a couple ILSs, and it was great just to be able to stare at my needles and keep them crossed. You're making tiny adjustments when you're on an ILS. And that is probably my number one biggest gripe with the G1000. And it works great when you're flying with the autopilot on. If the autopilot's shooting the approach, pretty much all this stuff works fine because all you're doing is staring at it. You've got plenty of time to look at all the stuff they're telling you and assimilate it. As soon as you're hand flying, it is not intuitive and it's not an easier system. That's been my take early on. And the synthetic vision on an ILS, again, you don't want to see these mountains floating out there. And even the runway floating in front of you, I find distracting. You know, you're flying your instruments. That's the whole point, is you know, I still think they teach instrument instruction to ignore the cues you're getting from your body and outside cues. You want to follow your instrument. I don't think that's changed. And putting all this extra information and this synthetic vision and these visual clues right in front of you detracts you from following your gauges. That's kind of one of my primary gripes with the system.
A word that comes to mind is sort of discipline, like self-discipline, and just in the sense that, you know, if you want to fly this technology that has, you know, unlimited options and all these tools that can help you in various ways, it really demands some discipline to stay in the loop mentally and to, you know, keep scanning things and to limit the number of things you're looking at unless you need them and make conscious choices about that stuff. And, you know, I don't know, maybe there are courses or books on this that I haven't seen, but it seems like, you know, everything focuses on just buttonology and learning which button does what and how to get all the information. But it seems like an additional skill that needs to be taught is sort of how do you incorporate all this stuff into, you know, your own flying habits and process and, you know, even setting personal limits with yourself in terms of the use of technology. Like what Aidan was saying, like if you are not comfortable flying with synthetic terrain on for whatever reason, you should turn it off and not feel bad about it because it will actually make you safer.
And let me pull out some of my, as long as we're on my gripes about the G1000, I'm just going to pull out some of my primary gripes, because some of them are things we haven't talked about. One is the glide slope and localizer not co-located, and then probably my biggest one. I personally don't like the vertical strips at all, but that could be a personal thing. And again, synthetic vision, all those extra things, you can turn them off. The other thing I found with the radios, because you've got one dial to work the two radios, and they rely on colors to clue you in as to what's going on. That's, again, an overly complicated system. Flying, going back to the steam gauges, it's so easy just to reach over and turn the dial on your radio. That also counts for the transponder. To change your transponder code, it is multiple movements on the PFD. And like flying the G1000, I don't do anything until I write it down. Anything ATC tells me, I write it down, and then I go back and try to figure out how I'm going to put it into the system. Whereas when I'm copying a clearance even in a steam gauge, I reach over and I dial in the transponder code. I don't even write it down. I just dial it in as they're talking because it's easy to do. You know, there's a lot of little things like that. The GPS for the G1000 is purple. Anything with GPS is kind of this pale purple color that they put on top of a brown background. That's really difficult to see. Now, these are nitpicky points, but they're points I think their testers should have brought up when they were flying the system. You know, purple on brown is not, they're not clearly defined different colors. Why not black and white? Or yellow and black, like you have on a lot of steam gauges. And I think they tried to get really clever with all these things they could do with the technology, and they overthought a lot of things. So those are kind of my biggest gripes. The radios are difficult to operate. I always write down a radio frequency now when the next one's given to me. I never just plug it in.
I'm kind of the opposite. I write down my clearance, but I can manage to plug in the altitude, heading, and radio frequencies as they're given to me when I'm flying.
So, and Alex, you never get confused in terms of which radio you're tuning or which side is the active side?
All the time I'll accidentally, you know, press from COM1 to COM2 and change the wrong frequency, or, you know, switch it from the active to non-active. So you really got to stay on top of that. I screw that one up all the time in the G1000.
Yeah, and that's why I just write, whenever they give me a new one, I write it down, and then I go back and pay attention to what I'm doing. Now, all that is more difficult if you're hand-flying in a thunderstorm or hand-flying a tight approach and they're giving you new commands. You know, I can't just reach over and dial them in. And I will say that the autopilot system, you know, where you can dial in the altitude, I'll do that by hand. That's easy to reach up and grab. I used to cheat with like ADF gauges to dial in altitude on steam gauges, but you can't do that on any of these systems. But they do have a good place to dial in the altitude. Almost all of this works fine if you're flying with the autopilot on. It's when you're hand flying that most of these discrepancies or these issues that I don't think are so great become a point. And I don't think it's any coincidence that Cessna is now putting autopilots in 172s out of the factory with these G1000s. I think the assumption is now that people are going to fly 90% of their time with the autopilot on and manage the flight system. I don't know if that's bad or not. It just seems to be the way it's going.
There's different interfaces for the G1002 that a Cirrus and a Cessna Mustang jet have like little keypads where you can type things in using the alphabet. And I can't remember if the Cirrus has this, but I know that the Mustang does. You know, it has, instead of all the knobs for course and altitude bugs and heading bugs, and all the autopilot stuff just integrated into the bezel of the PFD or MFD, it's actually on the glare shield as a horizontal strip, much like it is in most jets, and it's much easier to use. And I think a lot of the complication that people find with the G1000 is because there's multiple versions of every knob and button because it's duplicated on the MFD and the PFD. And then each knob and button can actually affect different things. You know, by pressing it, you tune both radios with both comm radios or both nav radios with one knob for each of them, and you have to, you know, push it to switch. So there's a lot more sort of cognitive involvement to use all this than there is in just standard, you know, radios where there's one knob for each radio for volume, one knob for each radio for frequency, a flip-flop button. It's just really clear. So I think it'll evolve, but it's just a whole different model, which it takes more thought. And as Aidan said, if you're on autopilot, you sort of have the luxury of taking that thought. But if you're not and the weather is bad and you're getting bounced around, you know, I haven't heard stories of this, but it seems to me like even what you were talking about, Alex, you know, a little error like that where, you know, you're tuning the wrong radio or flip-flopping to the wrong thing without realizing it, like generally that's not a big deal. But if you're having a real problem and there's lots of turbulence or bad weather or you have some emergency situation and that happens to happen at the same time you make a mistake like that and you're already overloaded, it just adds to the overload and that overwhelmed feeling.
Probably
has some bad consequence.
I don't know. The technology is going this way. From a personal standpoint, I prefer flying the steam. You know, Mike's heard me gripe about the computer screen that's trying to make my eyes go crooked. Like the Ryzen's always constantly in motion just a little bit. You darn near get seasick. But that's just that's just me. I just have to.
Oh, I see what you're saying. That like with steam gauges, especially if you're if you're VFR, you're looking out to the real horizon, which is far away, and little movements don't matter. If you're IFR, you can't see that. You're just seeing the little gauge that you can actually not look at occasionally.
But it doesn't register with the old vacuum gauges. You know, these small plane's always moving. It just doesn't register. It's not sensitive enough. But the computer screen is sensitive enough. It's constantly this. I mean, it's very slight, but it's there. And the airspeed and altitude are not so much altitude. The airspeed is usually constantly bouncing, you know, 2 or 3 knots, which, again, with a steam gauge, it just doesn't move because it's just not that sensitive.
A conversation I'd love to have sometime, and Aidan and I were talking about this, because I think I can probably find some professor somewhere who is an expert in avionics design. I think it would be fascinating to find out the history of avionics design. All these questions with the co-located glide slope indicator, all these kinds of things.
Like, I think that's I think that's the big one. And if you can visualize, you know, your scan, if there was a cross down on the HSI, your scan would be going more from, bottom center across to your airspeed up on the left, and maybe a little bit less to your altitude over on the right. And with that over there, maybe they determined that it balanced out the scan because you were moving your eyes over to the right more where the altitude is. So.
That's interesting.
I talked to an instructor about, say it's all set up because you're watching your horizon, and everything should be even with the horizon then when you're shooting an approach. Your glide slope should be even on the horizon.
That's right,
that guy
Gal then, right?
Yeah, exactly. It shouldn't be above or be below it. Your, airspeed should be locked in. You can put the little bug there, and you're just staring at this horizon that should be steady and neutral. And I said, and my comment is, that's great, except that you need to watch your localizer, and I think your localizer is actually your it's more important than the rest of it, than even your glide slope, because you've got to stay centerline on that runway. That's even more important than being on your glide slope. If you're roughly, depending on how fast you're going, 600 feet per minute down, and you've just set that up for your descent rate, you're going to be pretty close to the glide slope. And so I think they've kind of taken the localizer out of the whole scan, and I think that's one of the most important instruments on an approach. But again, autopilot on, it works just fine. Another thought that you were speaking about this morning, Mike, before we got this call going, was there's a belief that all of these systems are safer than the old steam gauges, that they're reducing accident rates. And there's no evidence to suggest that is what you were sort of finding.
Well, there was a study that came out in 2012 by the AOPA Air Safety Foundation, and it found that, contrary to what everyone was saying, that the accident rates weren't really decreased. And as a result of that study being published, everyone in the industry got really mad. And a lot of people were saying that, you can't look at something called a glass cockpit or technologically advanced aircraft and sort of do studies on that, because there's too many factors involved. And they were criticizing the study because you really have to ask, okay, what kind of training are these people getting before they start flying this technologically advanced equipment? How much time do they have? Where are they going? What kind of flying? Is it, a retrofit in an old aircraft? Is it a new, there's all these different factors. And just saying, glass cockpits are safer or not as safe, it's not really meaning anything, because, a glass cockpit by definition just sort of means a computer screen. And as we were saying at the beginning of this call, you can put anything on a computer screen, and that really has nothing to do with the safety or the usability issue. It's more about the design of what you put on there.
Cool. And I think that was part of what I want to do with call, sort of dispel the myth that these systems are automatically better and safer because they are the latest and greatest technology, and kind of get a meaningful conversation going on, and what is good about these systems, what's bad, and what these companies need to do something to change how they make their product, maybe make it more user-friendly. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah. Bailey, do you have any questions for these guys about anything even unrelated to this discussion?
Were you addressing me?
Yeah.
The only other thing I was thinking about, does anybody know offhand on what the weight of these new electronic displays are, replacing? Because they want to replace the whole, steam gauges with these new electronic ones. Are they heavier, lighter? Does it affect the CG any?
I don't know the exact answer. My guess is that it's lighter, but I don't think it affects the CG at all. But I would bet money that it's lighter, and that's something to be said actually for.
Yeah, you also have the panel stuff, but then you also have replaceable units that go in the back. That could affect the CG. Alex, you have any knowledge of that?
No. We had in one of the first ones in the caravan, we're going to Africa, I got a black screen over Egypt that night, and then it came back, and it was just a power connection in the back. I had to actually pull the whole thing out and check the where the, I don't know what you call it, but all the cable, it's not a Canon plug, it's a big plug-in jack, and that was not connecting. We got that problem sorted out, but it goes back pretty far, and it's not light. So it's
so a big arm on a not lightweight.
So I don't think that you're going to find that the overall weight is going to be that much different.
Okay.
Maybe the whole thing is going to be because it's more compact. Maybe it's going to be the equivalent, but I'm not the right guy to ask about that. So
that actually brings up another thing, and something that Alec, you and I talked about when we took those planes over to Africa, and I think this has actually been answered just by use. We both were thinking, is this good for remote operations, where it's an electrical system, you know, humid, rough, dusty environment? Is this going to make maintenance harder in the field or easier? And I've talked about that a little bit with Travis, and that there evidently it's working pretty well.
I haven't heard complaints. And you know, the problem I was anticipating was that you can't fix this stuff. You've got to send it back to Olathe, Kansas, and they'll send you a new one. And that's about all you can do most of the time.
And I think that's working for them because it's easier. If it does really break, they just send it back to, you know, it's fewer parts on
it. Yeah, and in theory, it would be expensive, but in theory, a company in, you know, a fairly remote place could have some backup stuff on hand. You know, if they had a fleet of planes, and then if something happens, you just put in the new one, and you don't even have to wait.
Yeah, and you don't have an inventory of all these gauges, which, you know, these are all, again, reasons why this technology is going to take over. You know, I remember airlines, you know, they'd have three or four attitude indicators, three or four turn and banks, and three or four HSIs, and when you'd have one break, you know, if they didn't have it, you'd get the comment from the DM like, well, we don't keep that in the inventory because they're expensive to have just sitting on a shelf. And with the G1000, a lot of that's eliminated. So that's, like I said, it's here to stay, and I should get over it and stop griping. But I would like to see some things change, and that glide slope localizer thing just bugs the Jesus out of me.
Yeah, I think it's terrific for the large aircraft, airlines and whatnot. I just not so sure about the small aircraft.
And I'm with you on that. I think for the large aircraft, two pilot crew, most of it's autopilot on. I don't think there's much question. I think it is definitely better. And that's kind of always been my thing, is to get into the smaller plane. Is this big airplane technology appropriate for the smaller airplane? Not just appropriate, but is it? How does it change the flying experience? Because if you're buying a 172, the odds are you're doing it partly because you want to fly and the experience of flight, and that's going to vary by the pilot. For me, the flying experience is a lot better with the steam gauges.
Yeah, I saw a glass cockpit in a modified Aviat Husky, and I screamed heresy.
Exactly. But they do it because it's cheaper. And it sells because it's the latest and greatest technology.
Yeah.
So it's a cheaper, easier system to put in. And when you sell it as this the latest and greatest system. Sort of like an automatic versus a standard shift in a car. I don't think we've solved the problems of the G1000, but
something I would suggest to anyone listening to this recording, which is something that Bailey pointed out at the beginning, is the beauty of all this computerized technology in airplanes is it's really easy to simulate because you're literally just simulating computer screens. So for most of this kind of stuff we're talking about, from a G1000 to other things, not only do the manufacturers make simulators in some cases that you can play around with, but there's add-on simulations for both Microsoft Flight Simulator and also X-Plane. That in a few cases, not all of them are great, but I've worked on some, and I know people who own companies that make some of these. Some of them go really, really deep and model, 80 or 90% of all the functions. And the advantage of using a simulation in conjunction with X-Plane or Flight Sim to get your head around all this stuff is you can do it while you're actually flying and trying to manage all the other aspects of flight, whereas the simulation that, Garmin makes that you can download, that's great for learning the system in terms of what button does what and what page is where, but it doesn't let you have that experience of using it in flight. And from my perspective as a sim guy, there's no excuse for getting into an airplane and being overwhelmed by this stuff, especially if you fly it frequently, because you really need to sit down and take the time on the ground to learn this stuff. I think an interesting challenge is people like Aiden and Alex, where you're ferrying planes and every plane is set up differently with different technology. You can't possibly take the time to do that with every piece of technology you're using. And that begs, an improvement to the interfaces and all that.
Well, so, you remember the ProLine 21, it's like I did sit down with you for an hour or so and go through the ProLine because you could simulate it on your computer. I think you had to get a hodgepodge of planes together to do it. But I'd never flown a ProLine 21. And when you get into these more advanced FMS systems, you actually have to know how to use something on it because it's not, the way it's designed is not necessarily intuitive. You just don't hit direct to and for your GPS. You have to be able to hit certain buttons a certain way. Exactly. And it was actually really, I would not have jumped in that King Air and been comfortable without that time sitting down with Mike in front of the computer and going through it. In fact, I wouldn't have known the program, although honestly, I cheated and had the mechanic program my first flight for me.
Okay.
Yeah, that was great. I was like, yeah, you want to do it? It'll take me a half hour. You go ahead and plug it in. We haven't even touched on touch screens.
Right.
The whole,
which is
another
a whole other
thing.
Yeah.
Well, I hate fingerprints on glass. So.
Well, I just talked to a friend of mine flying Scenic Tours in an A-Star down in Vegas, and they're going with the newer A-Stars, and they're all touchscreen glass cockpits. And the word he got was the pilots are not liking them. I did talk to a helicopter pilot who loved his touchscreen portable GPS. I personally do not like my touchscreen GPSs at all.
Is it because of the reflective surface?
It's not. It's they're very hard to use in turbulence, for one, which everybody talks about.
Oh, okay.
But you have to watch your finger touch the correct spot. When you've got knobs and dials, I'll reach over and I can do all kinds of stuff without looking at the unit at all.
Yep.
And with touchscreen, you cannot do that. And even I've heard people talk about in cars, the touchscreen GPS in cars are a problem because you can't operate them while you're driving. You actually need to pull over, if you're going to do it safely. Otherwise, you're always looking at the unit. And if you hit the wrong button, it'll take you back three pages before, and you've got to start all over again. Go ahead.
I was going to say, speaking of touchscreens, I know this should be done on a later time, but maybe we should have a discussion on, navigational software, iPads, ForeFlight, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've actually thought about that, and I've never used an iPad, or I've looked, played with them a little bit, I guess. I think it's awesome, and I think that's one reason they went for touchscreens, because iPads are touchscreens. but it's you use it differently, and it's also a multi-purpose tool. It's
true.
Just, you know, you don't just use it to fly.
And I've got one, but I'm trying not to use it. I'm noticing there's a trend, especially here with Embry-Riddle guys, North Air, and everybody's getting all excited over four flight, and they just they can't talk enough about it. And I'm sitting back here going, okay, you know, I haven't started yet. I want to learn, but I want to learn. I want to be an aviator. I want to learn the whiz wheel and or the little flight computer, whichever it is. But I don't want it to be done for me because I need to learn how to do pilotage. I need to learn all the basic hardcore piloting skills, you know, just in case I'm caught without an iPad or something that'll think for me. I need to be able to calculate wind correction angle and navigate without it being done for me. And that's my biggest thing right now is because I'm self-studying right now, so I'm in a pretty big rut right now because I'm just bogging down in these books trying to memorize everything, how to memorize, you know, all the equations that you need to know for everything from travel navigation to and whatnot. And but they got all these wonderful things that'll just do it for you.
And that's awesome. We actually, Mike and I have talked about we want to start producing a series of courses on how to fly retro flying.
Oh, wow.
I think they're good skills to learn, even if you don't really use them. And honestly, I haven't used a whiz wheel since I got my private.
Really?
You can get a lot just by, I do a lot of guesstimating.
Oh, okay.
Pretty accurate with it.
Like this, you know, this much fuel will get you this far, blah, blah, blah. That's the kind of thing I'm worried about.
Yeah, for fuel, always go extra. And GPS has helped with that. I wouldn't fight it too hard, but the future is in the iPads and the ForeFlight, and I think they're awesome technology.
Right. Oh, and I'm not fighting it. It's just I don't want to learn it yet.
Yeah. I think it might be easier now to actually, and this is me just totally talking off the cuff here, to learn with the new technology and actually then go back and then, you know, study the older systems. For your own knowledge, because as you learn how, as you get your ratings now, I don't think anybody's going to ask you the old questions, and it's more likely to get in the way of learning the new stuff. And to some degree, while you're getting your ratings, you just need to get your ratings. And I did some sim training recently, and they didn't want me to fly with the autopilot off. I actually talked them into it. Usually when I'm doing sim training, I take the autopilot off. I want to load myself up. And
right.
Their comments, I did this with two sim places I was training, actually, and both of them said, well, you're not going to fly with the autopilot off, so we don't want to teach you to do that. And even said that I talked to someone recently, did a check ride with an FAA guy who used to never let him, made him do NDB approaches and wouldn't let him fly with the autopilot on, and he came back 5 years later, did a check ride with the same Fed. And the Fed said, well, you know, he's going to do an NDB. Why did you do that? We don't do those anymore. And he went and turned the autopilot off. And he said, oh, no, leave the autopilot on. You're not going to fly with the autopilot off.
Yeah, I heard a bigger thing, AOPA safety thing on a lot of people flying, I mean, relying too much on autopilot, and they forget how to hand fly.
I think agents get avionic crash in San Francisco. It's not just general aviation pilots. It's people flying big jets. I concur with that. I think that is a problem.
Well, that's every airline pilot's complaint is that he's not really flying the airplane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Well,
we're hearing
I'm
that
happy
everywhere.
happy to say that I flew a Beaver on floats for the first time, and that's going back to about as old a technology as you can possibly get, and it was awesome.
Cool.
And I think Bailey, to sort of echo what you're saying, I think. You almost, and this doesn't have to do with ability to use it so much, but I think you have a better appreciation for all this new technology if you understand the old stuff. And I think it can make flying with the new stuff a little more satisfying. For example, you know, an iPad with ForeFlight, if that's all you've ever known, you don't think about the fact that you now have in your iPad what would have taken a desk or a bookcase full of charts, like paper charts. And I know talking to Aiden and Alex, when they go on these ferry flights, you know, they have a choice. They can take lots of paper with them, or they could take an iPad or, you know, other GPSs that include charts and have all that information at their fingertips. But with that and a lot of the other things that the technology sort of replaces and simplifies, it's just kind of cool if you know how it used to be done. A great example is if you look, if you've never done this, look sometime at photographs, just Google them, on Boeing, like Boeing 737 overhead panel. And you can look at the evolution over like the last 20 years at how each version of the plane and the overhead panel takes what was lots of stuff and makes it a few things. So, you know, the fuel system now is this little tiny panel with a couple knobs and dials. And three versions ago, it used to be like six knobs and dials. And then in the old days, it was actually a flight engineer.
Yeah, the flight engineer.
Separate, you know, a whole separate station. And it's really amazing that all that has been compressed into this little thing now. And I think that's true of all this stuff. If you look at a G1000 MFD and try to figure out what you would need in terms of, you know, paper and books to provide all that same information, you know, it's nuts and kind of cool.
Yeah, I agree with you. I actually went to an air museum up there by Colorado Springs, and I went on that B-29 Super Fortress and saw the flight engineer station, and they actually, on their long flights, some of them did the celestial navigation, which I just thought was insane, if they were doing any really high latitude flying.
Well, I used to fly the DC-6s, and first of all, that was great just to learn that everything's old school and analog, and we had little windows with the compass rose on them. The navigator, the Sapner, that they used to have navigators on them to actually take star sightings.
Yeah.
and I will say, having learned the DC-6, and I did a flight engineer ground school, they pulled me out at the very end to go fly some more. After I did that ground school, learning every other plane since then has been a lot easier because it was so in-depth into these systems, which still exist on every plane. We just don't interface with all these systems much, but it's actually learning the entire line of what you're doing. I move this lever, this is what I'm doing all the way through, and now a lot of that stuff happens automatically.
Wow.
Right.
That definitely improved my understanding about how most other planes are operating. So, Bailey, I think that kind of answers your question. That is useful to learn some of that old information. It will help you with the modern planes as well.
Okay. I mean, I look forward to using it.
Yeah. And some people don't care about that sort of historical throwback understanding because they're just all interested in cutting-edge technology, and that's why they got into flying. But, you know, chances are if you found all Oddball Pilot, you know, your heart's in it a little bit, too.
Yeah, I think that's – well, I'm actually psyched about trying to do these retro courses, but I think some of this stuff that I never knew or have forgotten would be really cool to go back and rehash. Like, Mike and I have talked about doing a simulator-based lesson on how to fly an MDB, you know, the old-school way. Hmm. And you brought up the whiz wheel, and that actually would be fun to – I think Alex is better at that stuff.
I'm still trying to decide what's best to start next month, either using the whiz wheel or the electronic E6B.
Oh, forget it. You know, use the whiz wheel.
Use the whiz wheel.
And
I'm told they're a little bit less accurate, but I don't know. I've got the little ASA, what they call the CX2.
But you need that to visualize to see where it came from, the circular slide rule and making your wind triangles. And then you can, once you practice a little bit with that, you know how to use it, you can forget about it and move on to doing it with the electronic.
Oh, okay. I want to be able to pass the written without goofing.
Unless you get really good with the whiz wheel, for the written, I would learn the electronic one. The electronic one will be easy to learn, but I think Alex is right. If you want to be able to actually visualize what you're trying to do, the whiz wheel is going to give you a much better feeling for, you know, what the calculation is giving you, what you're accomplishing with it.
Very helpful.
The whiz wheel
is
complicated.
I thought the whiz wheel was complicated on the one side where you do the, because it doesn't always tell you. I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain.
No, I know what you mean, which scale to, which the outer ring or the inner
ring.
Yeah,
which inner ring, outer ring, blah, blah, blah. But whenever I flip it over and do the wind correction angles, I love that side.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'll tell you what, this is, Mike and I have talked a lot about this. We're hoping this summer, because I'm going to have a pretty set schedule, that we'll be able to put some of these courses together. And I hadn't even thought of the whiz wheel, but that's actually a pretty easy one to do, and it forced me to go back, or Alex, one of us, to go back and figure out how to use the thing again. So that might be, Mike, you should make a note of that. We should, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Right.
I was just,
go ahead, Alex.
Oh, I was just afraid to forget how to, you know, which ring to use while I'm in that FAA exam. I'd be like, oh, no.
For the FAA exam, go electronic. I'm pretty sure they let you use them, because they were debating it.
Yeah, because this ASA one that I picked up, it's got a little menu, and it tells you right to go where. So.
Yeah, don't run the risk of failing your exam. Ugh. Learn the old stuff. Use the best technology you have available. But
all right.
Learn the whiz wheel for the fun of it.
And who's the simulation guy on here right now?
Mike.
Oh, Mike.
Mike, that's right. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm prepping myself right now, big time. I've got rudder pedals and a yoke and stuff, setting up a nice little flight simulator for my X-Plane 10.
Yeah.
And I'm working on add-ons. I just bought another one from Desktop Aviator. It's an actual physical representation of a flap switch, and it's got all the different degrees and whatnot. So I'm trying to get as realistic as I can, but the big thing I'm also worried about is radio comms. And the only software out there is, like, dated Windows 98. There's a lot of complaints for this program.
That like COM1?
Yeah, COM1, and people are...
Yeah.
They want $100 for it, and every reviewer got in there and said, this hasn't been updated since Windows 95 or 98, and it will not work with, you know, these newer operating systems. And I've tried a demo version of it, and they were not kidding. It, I don't know how they can honestly charge for that, but
I
just kind of wanted to learn.
I have a recommendation for you.
I'm sorry?
I have a recommendation for you.
So
there is a service, and I know the guy who started it, called Pilot Edge.
Pilot Edge, okay.
PilotEdge.net.
Okay.
And it's very simple. Basically, they have people who some are retired controllers and some are just very well trained, they basically provide human air traffic control for simulators.
Oh, awesome.
And that includes both people at home like you, but also a lot of flight schools are now using their service with their bigger sims. And it's basically, they staff the entire Los Angeles Center airspace, so all of Southern California. And all you do is you download some software. There's a free trial, and then you have to pay them every month. It's not very expensive. But then you download some software, and you log in. And then basically it just hooks into X-Plane, and you tune your radios to whatever you would really tune them, and you just assign a key or a button on a joystick or whatever to your push-to-talk button.
Right.
And you talk, and whatever controller would actually be answering on that frequency answers. And it is, from a communications perspective, it's exactly the same as it is. And you know, all those courses like COM1 are great, but the biggest problem people have with radio stuff, I think there's two problems. One is just a fear of talking on the radio and thinking, am I going to say the right thing? And the other is doing it while you're doing everything else. And there is nothing to compare to something like Pilot Edge for gaining confidence with both those things. Because it takes the whole simulation that you're doing and just makes it feel completely 100% real, because you know that real people are watching you and talking to you, and they're actually there to help pilots train. So they're not there to, you know, criticize you or screw you up. It's the opposite.
Wow.
And it's amazing. So I highly recommend it if that's something that you really want to work on.
I am, and thank you. I've bookmarked it.
Cool. Any other questions for or thoughts for Alex or anything else?
Well, I just wanted to say there seems to be, for the foreseeable future, there's going to be enough analog instruments on all the airplanes that you want to pass the word to people to be proficient on analog when they're doing their instrument training.
And it won't hurt. It won't hurt their flying overall either.
Nice. Yeah, cool. I'd say that's a good point, Alex. Especially for instrument training, like, you know, if you learn on glass just as a private pilot, and then you know learn how to fly a Cub or jump into a 172 that doesn't have glass, like you'll figure it out. But to fly on instruments, if you're used to glass and suddenly you're without that, that's really challenging, I would think. You know, I didn't go in that direction, and neither did you, but I can imagine that would be really difficult because that would feel like somebody's taking away what you learned on, which for instrument flying could be really difficult.
Yeah, I'll never know, but you need to be able to do both for now.
Yeah, I think you really do in this. Even if you're going to the airlines,
I'm anticipating for it because it's going to be a while before I can build up to, you know, the 1,500 hours
Yeah.
So the journey to that, I'm pretty sure they're going to be sticking me into some very interesting old birds.
Well, even if you go like the AAR route, and I've actually interviewed with AAR.
Oh, you did?
And a friend of mine, the Fed, who does their check rides for the CASA, these contractors are going to be around a while. They like prior military.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
They do like it. And they pay well.
Yes, they do.
One of these contractors I just spoke to, I took a plane to, he was making just under 300 grand a year.
Oh, my gosh. That's a fraction of what I made over there.
Yeah, he was definitely, he kind of laughed. He worked a good deal for himself.
I made a fraction of what they made over there. But, yeah, I talked to them just, you know, the AAR guys that was stationed with me was running the Sikorsky 64 helicopters. And then when I went over to Mezar Sharif, they were running the Dash 8s, and they were all steam gauge and whatnot. Got some very interesting stories out of these guys, and pretty cool. Much better rotations than what we got, you know.
Oh, yeah. They're doing 2 months on, 2 months off.
Yes.
Things like
and here I was stuck there for a year, and it was like being in prison.
Oh, man.
You know, it was, except for my, you know, I took a short R&R, and I got to go to Germany for 3 weeks via the Luftwaffe. I got to fly, went to Mezar Sharif via Canadian Air, or Canadian helicopters. We call them Molson Air. And I was always riding in Molson Air's Huey, Bell 212, and hop on over to Mez. And then from there, I hopped on a German 160, which is like a, the German version of an AC-130, but it's a two-engine. And, of course, they got to do their tactical landings, which I think they're just trying to see how many people that can get to puke on me in the back. And we would hop on, you know, it would be a 20-minute flight over to Uzbekistan to their logistics base. And from there, we'd get on an Airbus and then fly straight over the Black Sea.
Cool. That sounds like a good runway.
The
pilots have better schedules.
Oh yeah, yeah. I learned that real quick, but it was fascinating being over there, seeing all the different aircraft. And I'll have to send you a video because we had a bunch of the Afghan National Army training with the old Russian Mi-8 transport choppers.
Uh-huh. Yep. You're starting to see some of those pop up in the. With Western operators too, mainly Australian, which is interesting.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. I know the UN uses them in Afghanistan.
The UN World Food Program, they're cheap.
Yeah. And then, but I also was nice to see that the UN was using Dash 8s as well.
It's funny, they use the old crappy, well, they use a lot of Antonov, they use a lot of old Russian fixed wing stuff too. Interestingly, I was talking to a company called East Horizon, which flies, it's a commercial company out of Kabul, and they're looking at getting some Antonovs. And they actually held off, they're all so old, and the Chinese are evidently making copies of a lot of the Antonovs.
Oh, wow.
So you're going to start seeing some new Chinese versions of the Russian planes. And that'll be, a lot of them aren't that good, I don't think. The air truck's pretty cool.
Yeah. Sounds scary.
It's, well, the Nepalese guys, they flew the Russian or the Chinese version of the Twin Otter, the YS-11, I think it was.
Really?
And, yeah, they said it just was not as good as the Twin Otter. Whatever they've done, it just wasn't. They reverse engineered, it should be identical, but they said it's not. It just never flew as well.
I got to run. You can keep talking if you want. Aiden, just text me when you're done, and I'll stop the recording and all that.
I think that's probably a good time for Alex. Probably got to get back to all the kids and everything, and I've got a long run to do. So.
Okay.
All right.
I did have one more thing for you, Aiden.
Yep, sure.
Was it you that was talking about the landslides and control of that and whatnot?
Yeah, that was Alex.
I brought it up because Aiden was just in that part of Afghanistan, and I'm sure he was in a village that was wiped out.
You were talking about somebody that was flying and doing some like soil control or avalanche control or whatnot.
Yeah, it was an Italian gentleman. He runs an NGO called Alpistan, and he was looking at avalanches and how to help villagers in the case of avalanches and education about when they can occur, how to forecast them.
Okay.
And I just had an email from him, and that was something I wanted to ask him an email back, is he thinking of getting into this mudslide? It's a lot more deaths from mudslides than avalanches.
Oh, wow.
That's a lot of people.
Hmm. Not something entirely related, but I did a cat mission a couple of years ago when we had the Big Bear fire over here in eastern Arizona.
Yeah.
And we went over there to do a photo assessment of all the damage. Went over to Springerville, Arizona, and while we were there, they had one of the runways completely shut off, and it was being run by all these some sort of a crop duster airplanes that were running off of there, and one Huey, and we couldn't talk to them because they were so busy and whatnot, but they were going back and forth and dumping some sort of solution or chemical in the burnt areas to prevent mudslides. And I was trying to get some more information. I got some pretty cool pictures of these guys, but it was one heck of an operation, and they were just coming in and out and just putting that stuff all over the place. But I wasn't able to get in for any more information from this.
All
it was intriguing.
Around, that would be the Air Tractor 802, the Fire Boss, I'm sure, that they were flying, the processors.
Pretty high-powered.
I've been into 1,300 horsepower PT6. I've been in a lot of communication with a bunch of different fire bomber outfits, Air Attack and all that. I haven't done any real interviews. But I'm hoping this winter to go back and actually nail them down to get some interviews. And I will ask them about that because they will have information. I don't know what chemical they're using, but that's an interesting application.
Yeah, I just wanted to get that out to you because it was quite an impressive operation when we landed over there.
Yeah, I will make a note of that, and I'll bring it up with the firebomber folks, and I'll mention it to Ferdinando. I don't think he has the means of making that work, but I'll...
And they had us fly 500 AGL over there and made it a point for me to zoom in and get all the – because we have a camera, an Nikon, hooked up to a GPS unit. And we get all the – I mean, every picture I get gets the Latin Lounge. And they made it a point for me to get as many areas that I suspect that would look like there would, you know, be potential mudslides.
This sounds like a whole other conversation. I'll have to be in touch with you on that. That sounds interesting right there, actually. The whole firefighting division is interesting.
Yeah, they were also talking about contracting us here in Yavapai County to give them fire direction reports.
Because
we're a lot cheaper to run than say a helicopter.
We will have to talk more about that. Yeah, and drones. Drones are going to take over that whole market, I think.
Oh, wow.
That's in 10 years. It's going to be a ways, but it's coming.
True.
So, again, that's another discussion. But cool.
Well,
that sounds good. Yeah, Bailey, if you think of anything else, send me an email or a message on the network. And,
okay.
I'll be up in the mountains for a month, but I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Hey, great. And
cool.
I think that's about it. And I believe I told you that, yeah, I was going to start down here so I can get that high-density altitude training, kind of get used to the hot, thin air.
Yeah.
And then I was going to head up to the north, back up to home to the northwest to finish my training on the other ratings.
Yeah, well, Bend is a great place to do it, and they've got a couple good flight schools there now. I've liked their flight schools. I've talked to there. Bend would be a good place.
I'm weighing either that or Snohomish.
Oh, Snohomish. I flew skydivers there. Snohomish is awesome, too, but Bend is better weather. You'll get more flying in.
Okay. Well, have fun in the mountains.
Cool. Thanks, Lydia. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Bye, guys.
Good conversation.
Excellent conversation.
All right, talk to you later.
All right, bye.
Bye. And that's Aiden with Oddball Pilot. We'll wrap up the Garmin G1000 discussion.
Keep the shiny side up and the greasy side down.